Welcome to Killing It on Broadway. I'm Jennifer Samard.
And I'm Jessica Vosk, and this is the podcast where we discuss all things guts, gore, murder, and mayhem.
It's not safe for work. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, Jennifer.
And hi, Kate Weatherhead.
Hello, ladies.
Oh, my gosh. I have to say, I have not gotten to see Kate in person or on Zoom for a very long time, Zoom ever. And I'm one of Kate's biggest fans. Fight me. I'm so happy that you're here today with us. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thanks for having me. I'm going to start my own podcast and it's going to be called Third Wheel. And every episode, I'm just going to try to like get in on this friendship.
That sounds like us, Jess.
Yeah. It's just going to be me being like, so what do you guys want to do tonight?
Let's talk murder documentaries.
Yeah.
I mean, that's that. Let's talk which one we're going to watch. That's really what this is.
Yeah.
Naturally.
Absolutely. Now, we were talking before we started recording that we have known each other for 15 years. Isn't that right?
Yes. Which is astounding.
Starting with Finding Nemo.
Yeah.
Oh, I got you. Well, Kate, you are so loved by so many in our industry. You know, there are those people in our industry who are like, I love her. I love you. You always hear
Absolutely.
Good things. Kate is one of those people. You have a terrific career. Yet today, we're not here to talk about that whatsoever. We don't care. I'm sorry.
It's okay. Fine.
I know. But Kate, basically, here's the deal. All we like to talk about in our lives, especially, is true crime. We realized in our history as friends, we are obsessed with it. We know a ton of our colleagues are obsessed with it too. We've had so many chats with so many colleagues who we didn't know were as obsessed as we are. We've often sat in the privacy of our own apartments or homes. I know I've been like, could I possibly be a serial killer? Am I a psychopath, a sociopath? Why do I love this so much? Was I meant, like, did something happen to me? Do I not remember it in my past life? Who did I hurt? So that being said, the first question that we have for you, Kate, is, when did you first realize that you had an interest in true crime and why are you into it? And why do you think that we as actors are so into it?
Well, I've been thinking about this because I've also been now listening to your podcasts. And so they've activated my memory and my imagination a little bit on this subject. And so I can't pinpoint a specific moment or case. But I've been sort of thinking about, like, what is it in my personality that makes me curious and receptive to these kinds of stories? And I don't know if this is a direct link, but I do think there's something to it, which is that from the time I was a little girl, anything bad that happened to anyone, I assumed it would happen to me. So if somebody broke their arm, I was like, when I break my arm, I never thought, oh, I'm so glad I didn't break my arm, or I wonder what would happen. And it was always like, when I break my arm, this is what I'm going to want people to write on my cast.
Wow.
I was in preschool with a little girl who got appendicitis, which was like an enormous word to learn when you're four. And I was like, when I get appendicitis, will I be in school? Will I have to be taken out early? Mm-hmm. You know, it was just this like...
It's kind of like a version of Debbie Downer, like Fanny Foreshadow,
mm-hmm.
right? You're just like, that's going to happen to me. What a good defense mechanism, right? Like, prepare yourself for the worst.
Well, I definitely am a cautious person, and I think it's because it's a fear-driven instinct. And it certainly has sort of manifested in like a weird hypochondria as I've gotten older. But nevertheless, what I think that does is I sort of place myself in the center of these stories. So I always, when I hear them, I am suddenly in the middle of it because I'm only imagining what would happen if I was in this situation. Like I lay in bed planning my exit strategy for when the murderer clicks open the door. I'm like, what's the first thing? What's the heaviest piece of furniture I can put against the door?
Get it, girl.
Oh,
snaps.
Will I kill Willa if I throw her out the window before me? Do we jump together? How far down the road can I get in bare feet without...
Yeah, you know, two things about this. Brad laughs at me because I'm, honey, have you deployed the security device? I sometimes make him put a chair in front of the bedroom door. It'll give us an extra 2 seconds before our demise. Like, what the hell? But it makes me more comfortable. Number two, Jessica, hearing Kate talk, it reminds me of what you're saying all the time, how you're such an empath. right? And putting yourself in the center of the story, I think, is a way of showing that kind of empathy, right? You're that person. You're in their shoes. Sure. Do you agree with me? Do you disagree with me? What do you guys think?
Yeah, because as Kate was saying, if that happens to somebody, it could happen to me. And I feel like that could transfer into our business. Like, so-and-so won this award when I win it.
I will admit.
Do you know what I mean?
I will admit I do that quite frequently as well.
Yeah, see? Do you see how I therapized it? Yeah. And so I love that. I know that I have personally thought about my escape route. I've personally thought, like, I don't know if you've ever done this. Anybody out there listening, to our killers out there listening. If you've gone to an Airbnb or you've been, like, I've taken a weekend alone in the country and been in the middle of the woods and I decided to read a thriller.
Tricky.
What a mistake. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing, Jen. The chair in front of the door, I took a knife from the kitchen,
yep,
and put it next to the bed, thinking that, like, and no joke, you guys, I always think if I'm going to be approached by somebody that I'm going to have my shit together. And I have had it happen before where somebody's like approached me in a weird way. And I've been like, I can't handle it.
Yeah.
What about the knife though? Don't you sit there and go, well, statistics say this is going to be used against me. Like there's that anxiety.
That's what I think too, is I go, I have no upper body strength. They're getting this knife and like, a split second. They're wrestling any weapon out of my hand immediately.
I've got an idea, you guys. I'm going to get us all for Christmas. I'm going to get us all brass knuckles, and we have to sleep with them on our hands.
I don't mind that. It's very much like a Fitbit.
Right?
Yeah. I don't mind it at all. I think anybody listening right now, I know anybody listening right now has done this, has had the feelings that Kate has had, has slept with a knife by their bed or like a taser. Thanks, Mom. And my parents live in Florida. Maybe they sent me a taser. But you know what? As a woman as well, when people always ask, like, what's it like to be a woman in the big city? Or what, you know, you have fears, mm-hmm, don't sure. we?
Yeah.
I mean, that's not it's not something that I would ask a guy, like, are you also afraid to walk at night? And are you constantly like, you can't look down at your phone and you have to, you know, that's the stuff I think about. And now that I'm such a true crime fanatic, I think about all of the things that I need to do. Like, okay, I should keep my video on in case something happens, mm-hmm, right?
Yeah, for mm-hmm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, Kate, you are from Vermont. Is that correct?
True, yes.
The case we're covering today, ooh, Stowe, Vermont.
I grew up in Burlington, which is 40 minutes away, 45.
Okay.
But I grew up going there because it's this very idyllic, dare I say, cliche Vermont town. It's just bucolic and touristy and beautiful and like, you know, lots of postcards are of Stowe. And so it is a town that I'm very familiar with and have very specific associations with, mostly having to do with picturesque scenery.
Yes. And that is the northern part of Vermont, northwest.
Mm-hmm, correct.
Because I think we even talked about this once, because I was from the south section of New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry that your state is upside down.
Oh, yes.
But, and you would tell me that, no, Jen, your state is upside down. Anyway, well, look at a map, you guys.
Sisses.
I know,
stop
they
fighting.
Look the same. Mm-hmm. But okay, so you're from Burlington, Vermont, but that is a hop, skip, and a jump from mm-hmm Stowe, Vermont. We got some of our information today from caselawfindlaw.com, Vermont Community Newspaper Group, The Stowe Reporter, telegram.com, vundergrund.com, and cornellalumnimagazine.com. And Kate requested that we do this case, and we are in full agreement. This is the case of Patricia Scoville. Now, Patricia Scoville was a bright young lady, originally hailing from Canandaigua, New York. She was a 1986 graduate of esteemed Cornell University, following in her parents' footsteps, David and Ann Scoville, who graduated in 1961, 25 years prior to their beloved daughter. Like her mother, Patricia majored in family development and human studies. After spending some time in Winchester, Mass., which is a tiny suburb about 9 miles north of Boston, and on a personal note, you guys, one of my brothers lived there for many years. Speaking of bucolic, it's just this beautiful little village outside of Boston. Anyway, she moved from there to Stowe, Vermont in the fall of 1991. Now, for context, Stowe was about a 3-hour drive from Winchester, Mass., and over a 6-hour drive away from her hometown in Canandaigua, New York.
Just a side note.
Yeah.
Having worked in Rochester, or as I like to call it, Rochacha, I have spent some time in Canandaigua. I have spent some time on the Canandaigua Lake. So I just want to say, it's so beautiful. We call it the Finger Lakes. And it I don't normally like a lake situation because I don't like, oh God, what if I jump in the lake or the pond and I feel something on my feet that happens to be an animal or a seaweed situation? I know it's not in freshwater, but you know what I'm saying? And I'm not wearing the shoes. That's not like that in the Finger Lake. It's like deep ocean water. So, hey, Canandaigua, that's all I just wanted to say because it's so beautiful. So moving on, it's October 1st. 1991, when Patricia moves to Stowe, Vermont, and she moves into a two-bedroom apartment with her roommate, Annette Dickinson Shue. And just 3 weeks later, on October 21st, 1991, according to reporting by Scott Monroe, Annette said Patricia was, quote, giddy that morning, getting ready for a bike ride and eating chocolate chip cookies she had just baked.
And just to literally inject some color into this, October in Vermont is one of the most beautiful times of year anywhere in the world. So this young woman relocated to a place that looked like an autumnal fairy tale. So it makes perfect sense to me, having grown up there, that she would have been giddy that day in anticipation of her bike ride through nature and making a batch of chocolate chip cookies. So there's something.
It's very picturesque.
Very provocative.
It's a Nora Ephron moment film, which is funny because to our listeners, Kate had no idea of what I'm about to just say, but she might be a psychic because we were going to recount the weather that day. And Kate recounted it without knowing that we were going to recount it. So all I'm saying is I don't know about special skills, but
She's a local.
But on October 21st, on this particular day, it was partly cloudy in Stowe, Vermont. It reached a high of 50 degrees by about noon. And Scoville biked to Chittenden Bank on Mountain Road, where she cashed a check for $56.25 and deposited $538. Now, the bank teller, Ramona Doty, her nickname is Doty Spaulding, testified she handled the transaction and saw Scoville bike away at about 1:40 p.m. So she biked down to Route 100 to Moss Glen Falls, which is a scenic area on the northern edge of Stowe. Kate, have you been to Glen Falls? Tell us about Glen Falls.
It's possible. Again, my memory is fuzzy, and there's lots of pretty waterfalls all around that state, so it's quite possible I've been there, but I cannot confirm or deny.
Okay. What do you have to hide, Kate?
What do you have to hide, Kate?
That's all right. We'll get back to that. That's another podcast.
I mean to be so forward. So on this particular afternoon, Patricia, she parks her bike against a tree, grabs her yellow water bottle, climbs to the waterfall, and sits on a rock. She took off her black gloves, set them on the rock, and it was here, while she was enjoying the scenic surroundings, where Howard Godfrey found her.
Now, fast forward 48 hours to October 23rd. By this point, her roommate, Annette, is very concerned, of course, and she reports Patricia missing to the police. Concurrently, reports were coming into the police department about an unattended green bicycle found at Moss Glen Falls. On October 24th, police found the bicycle, a pair of black gloves, and a yellow water bottle, all later identified as Patricia's. On October 29th, 6 days after the missing person report is filed, police find Patricia Scoville's body in a rural wooded section of Moss Glen Falls.
Now, here's our trigger warning as we start describing some of the evidence that was presented in court. Now, according to the state's medical examiner who performed an autopsy on Patricia, he found lacerations and bruises indicating blunt force injuries on Scoville's head and face, as well as neck injuries that were characteristic of strangulation and asphyxiation. They concluded that oxygen deprivation due to manual and/or ligature strangulation was the cause of death. The medical examiner additionally provided testimony that Scoville's vaginal area had been subject to trauma or injury. Now, remember before we mentioned Patricia, she had baked some chocolate chip cookies, and this innocent innocuous act actually helped establish the timeline, because the autopsy of Patricia also involved an examination of her stomach contents, which revealed the presence of theobromine, a chemical that is typically found in chocolate. This is one of the cool, I don't want to say it's cool because this is an awful story, but something that I find solves a lot of murder cases, don't you think, guys? When they examine the contents of somebody's stomach to see the exact timeline of when they were alive?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, the science of it, to know how long something takes to digest. That must vary from food to food, and because science.
I know, but this has solved many a crime.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's one of those things that when, as you were saying at the beginning of the episode, you know, could you be a serial killer? Are you a serial killer? And when I, again, placing myself in the center of stories, I go like, could I do it and get away with it? And then you hear something like this about just like how forensics work. And I go, oh, no, they'd catch me in half a day.
Like, lickety split.
Yes. Yeah, because what they're piecing together is so far beyond the scope of my understanding of how cases get solved.
Yeah.
And this especially, I mean, to even go further here, the medical examiner testified at the trial that theobromine is normally completely emptied from the stomach within 4 hours after consumption, and that digestion ceases upon death. So if chocolate had been consumed around noon on October 21st, when Scoville had been seen eating cookies, it would have been undetectable unless Scoville died before 4 o'clock p.m. that same afternoon.
So we're going to move on with the story, but Jessica, is it also fair to say that you'd constantly have chocolate in your
stomach? You have no idea what I was just going to say, but you also know what I was just going to say.
I know you. I know.
This episode is brought to you by our best friends at Spindrift. Yes, you heard me. Best friends. For those who know us, you know how addicted we are to true crime and sparkling water. Cue the day when we were both starring in Broadway shows and stumbled upon the Holy Grail, Spindrift.
America's first sparkling water with real squeezed fruit. Yep. That's it. 11 flavors with no worries about any chemicals going into your body. You'll have a crush on all flavors. Trust us.
Oh, and they make the perfect mixer for your holiday bevies, too.
Ugh, the possibilities are endless. Just go now to drinkspindrift.com, find your match, and use our sassy sparkling code KILLIT20 at checkout and get 20% off your first order. Self-care, baby. After all, it's necessary in 2020.
Okay, now we are going to fast forward about a year. And while this is the story of Patricia Scoville, it is also the story of a few more incredible people, including Patricia's parents, David and Anne Scoville. In 1994, some remarkable legislation was passed. The Federal DNA Identification Act of 1994 establishes a national database of samples from convicted felons. At this time, Vermont was one of only two states in the country that did not have a statewide database coordinated with a national database of DNA evidence. And so, remarkable and grieving, David and Anne Scoville started to lobby for it. They live, as we said, 6 hours away in upstate New York, but they consistently and periodically traveled to Vermont to make sure their daughter was not forgotten. Fast forward to 1996, and another remarkably brave individual who vicariously brought justice to our case. On August 19th, 1996, Howard Gottfried bludgeoned a woman by the name of Karen Kieran in the back of the head with a wooden mallet and threatened her with a shotgun. Karen managed to survive her attack and escape the situation by not only fighting back, but by talking him into letting her go. Police soon found him hiding in the woods, whereupon they arrested him. According to reporting by Lisa Rathke of the Associated Press, Karen had heard of the case of Patricia Scoville and thought her attacker was one and the same. Howard Gottfried was convicted in 1997 of this aggravated assault.
Ooh. Hmm. Now, on April 29th, 1998, our heroes, the Scovilles, persuade Vermont lawmakers to allow the state to be part of the National DNA Database System. As you've heard us talk about this before in several episodes, it's called CODIS, or Combined DNA Index System, and to require the Department of Corrections to collect DNA samples from felons convicted of violent crimes. Now, on May 24th, 1999, the Federal Bureau of Investigation receives a DNA sample from the Scoville killing and stores it in the national database. The following year, on January 21st, 2000, the Vermont Forensic Laboratory takes a sample from Howard Gottfried. Now, we're not sure why there is a 5-year delay between taking the sample and the next step. But on February 23rd, 2005, Gottfried's blood sample is finally entered into the federal DNA database. And 5 days later, on February 28th, 2005, lo and behold, it is a match to the homicide of Patricia Scoville. By the end of March in 2005, police gathered current DNA samples of Gottfried by collecting his discard. You know I love this. You know I love when they do this. They collected his discarded cigarette butts, and he's finally arrested for Patricia's murder on March 30th, 2005.
This is something that we'd all be very good with, particularly Kate Weatherhead in one of her 15 famous characters that she just recently did off Broadway, just in a car, having a coffee, a donut. Maybe there's a mustache. Maybe I don't know which character you think, but you know. And then he just dropped the cigarette butt. I'm gonna change costumes. I'm gonna quick change, and I'm gonna go out and get it. You know, like that's I think right. You'd be very good at that, don't you think?
So, are you suggesting that my quick change is from like a cop to an auto mechanic or a?
You know what? Led you to water and you drank. That is exactly right. I think that's exactly what I'm suggesting. Thank you.
Great.
I want to see it. So I know that I want to see it.
I'm just going to go check the pressure on the tires and...
I'm certainly not looking to get your DNA off the cigarette butt. That's for sure.
I'm just Mike the auto mechanic. I don't...
God, do you understand the excitement this gives me? I mean, it just makes my stomach have butterflies thinking about it. I want Kate to create this sort of show called CODIS. And she is responsible for collecting DNA from odd places.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to fantasize about, I wonder if I could get away with murder. I think we're allowed to fantasize that you're literally every portion of the evidence gathering team.
That's perfectly acceptable. Yeah.
Yeah.
I say Kate is.
For sure.
All right. Well, getting back.
That's what we do. Passionate.
You're my Italian stallion.
I know.
It's okay. Kate, what is your background? What is your heritage?
Oh, there's a lot of European descent. So there's Polish and Irish and maybe a little English or Welsh. I have not done, what is it called?
23andMe, babe.
I was about to say 33andMe. I guess that's
more ambitious.
Want
to do it, but I'm too afraid to. I feel like that's it. They're gonna I feel like they're gonna put me in some sort of database and frame me for a crime. That's how my mind works.
They will, and you know, you just have to, think to yourself, what do I have? I'm not. That's not me. As Kate said, we would not be. I would leave a seltzer can as a trail,
that's right.
And that would be. The murder would be solved like this. I don't have that in me.
Can I tell you one story, you guys, about a DNA story with me? Yeah. So this is how paranoid I am about all this stuff. Mm-hmm. So I walk down the sidewalk one day. I have a hangnail, and it was driving me nuts. So I kind of tear it, and it falls to the sidewalk. Now this is a pale color, right? It's hard to see on a white sidewalk. I turn around, I go back on hands and knees searching for the hangnail, because I'm convinced someone's going to find it, and they're going to plant it on me, and I'm going to be convicted.
Wow.
Because of crimes I didn't commit because of my GD hangnail.
Okay, Jen, that is as deep as you've gotten. And that's, I don't know what to say about it. Kate?
I was just thinking, do you have enemies that you know of who would do something, who would want to frame you?
That's I'm sure question. They're out there.
No,
I'm sure of it.
I disagree. In the same vein as you saying that I was well liked within our community, I would say, Jen, you are even more beloved. So it's really hard to imagine, John Tartaglia.
You know what? We're keeping this in. I'm going to tweet this at him, and he better convince me otherwise. Let me know that he won't do that. He might do that.
He would love nothing more than to talk about it with you.
And that's how John Tartaglia became a person of interest. Just like that. Snap.
See?
Yeah.
Yeah, John, where are your hangnails? Mm-hmm. Where are your hangnails?
Yeah. Okay, John, we're on to you.
That's deep, Jen. I don't. That's deep.
It's not healthy. It's like go see a doctor.
Yeah, I'm not telling you that you need to do that, but I'm saying that if you needed to work that out for yourself, because I've been known to have a hangnail, situation or like, mm-hmm. you know, take my nail polish off and it's on the ground. And not yeah. once have I ever said to myself, mm. oh, okay. I wonder if the FBI guy is going to come pick this yeah. shit up.
Well, I'll come visit you in jail. Now, getting back to our story.
Oh, right. That.
Yeah, that. So getting back to this horrible story. In January 2008, the trial is held in White River Junction, where more than 30 witnesses testify. That's a lot of witnesses. More than 30 witnesses testify. And after just 2 hours, the jury found Howard Godfrey guilty of aggravated murder. The charge carried an automatic sentence of life in prison without possibility of parole. And we always love the stories where the jury is out that quickly. It's because oh, yeah. we always talk about how it's like, oh, not only did you do it, you really did it, and we know you did it. On May 22nd, 2008, the day before Godfrey's sentencing, this is a very beautiful light at the end of this very terrible story. Vermont named their forensic DNA laboratory after Patricia, calling it the Patricia Scoville Memorial CODIS Laboratory. In an article by David Dudley for Cornell Alumni Magazine, Patricia's father, David, is quoted as saying, quote, "We set out to do something and we got it done," end quote. And that, my dear girlfriends, is the case of the taken too soon Patricia Scoville. Yeah. So to follow up, how about those parents, right?
That's my favorite part of the story. It's why it was the most appealing to me is that yeah, there
that's
was...
That's what I was going to ask you, Kate. I want to know why it was so appealing to you.
It appealed to me for, I think, for three main reasons. One, that it happened while I was a teenager, just a few miles away. So the sort of chills that run up my back as I imagine, like, what was I doing on that day? I was probably in play practice. I was probably feeling really secure about my life, you know. And meanwhile, in this absolutely gorgeous setting, this young woman full of promise came to a premature end. And, you know, that is the goosebump part for me. The other part is, and really the biggest part, is the heroism of the parents and how they took something so devastating, so horrific, and channeled that despair into activism with unbelievable results. I mean, they did not do it convinced that they were going to find their daughter's killer. They were just trying to create a world in which those kinds of crimes could be solved. And the fact that it actually delivered their daughter's killer is, I think, absolutely extraordinary. And then yeah. the third has to do with the killer himself, Howard Godfrey, because I was reading one of the articles gave more of a backstory for him. And something that really struck me was his loner status, because a lot of times the psychology of the killer is explored and there's this, like, you know, this obsessive need to kill. And this guy, I think, had a lot of rage, but he was also still a Vermonter. And I will explain what that means. Like, Vermonters are very self-reliant. They keep to themselves. They don't like to bother other people. Really independent. And it just felt very on brand that this guy would do something terrible and yet successfully compartmentalize it in such a way that he never told anybody. Like, he just...
Good point. Everyone
is really good at keeping to themselves in that state, even when they're a cold-blooded killer. So that was interesting to me, that this guy did something so awful and then just returned to his life, his quiet, probably very angry life, and then a few years later got angry at another woman, couldn't keep it together, bludgeoned her, was unsuccessful in killing her, and that was ultimately the thing that led to his undoing. But unlike these other, you know, serial killers, and it was very interesting to me that this guy was able to really sort of perpetrate these isolated events.
Oh, yeah.
And to me, the whole thing felt like a Vermont crime.
That's interesting. Because, jinx. I would also, to add on to that, because what Kate just said about the psychology of a killer, sometimes, and I wonder if this was the case, it's like the compartmentalizing of it, yes. But then the little area in your brain that just makes you think it was okay. And it's, that happened. And I did that thing.
And I took care of it.
And I took care of it. And that's how I took care of it. And now I'm going to chop some wood. Mm. And again, we always go like, wasn't there an easier way to take out your rage? Like, couldn't you just go to a boxing class or go to your therapist, have a discussion about it? But the brain doesn't work that way with killers, right?
Yeah. He died in jail in 2013. And I guess the other part of it that I think of as a woman, Kate, to your point, I bet you guys do too, is how many times have you ladies been on a hike by yourself in the woods?
I refuse to do it alone now.
I won't do it.
Yeah. You won't do it anymore.
I don't think I ever did it.
Really?
I'll never go
or
alone.
Or a park. I mean, a park. You won't go alone.
A park, yes. Even around my neighborhood. Even I'm just outside of New York City, and there is a beautiful park about 20 blocks north of me. But if I go after dark, I get very nervous. Like, I just do. But everything's lit. But I just don't know who's going to pop out of somewhere. These are the things that we have to think about. I don't want to be the person who just glosses over the fact that this is a thing that happens, because it is. It's a thing that happens. So I do not, if I hike, like, again, like all men, like who are COVID negative, apply. I will go on a hike with you and we can hug.
Right. It's interesting. I don't even know if I've ever expressed this out loud, but it's a sorrow of my life that I have not felt that I could enjoy sort of the greatest offering of my home state by myself. I have these, romantic fantasies of going on these hikes and walking through the woods, because sometimes you just want to be by yourself.
Amen.
And I won't do it because of stories like this. For me, the risk so outweighs the reward. Because
a lot of the time it's wrong place, wrong time.
That's
you know
right.
what I mean?
Like, and there's nothing have anything to do with you. In that scenario, I couldn't run fast enough. I could not defend myself. And so I wouldn't be able to enjoy it. But I've gone on many hikes in my life with other people. And I always look at the dude with the dog passing by. And, he's just having a great day. And I think, good for you.
I think you're so poetic how you put it, that, one of the great sorrows of your life. And I think with all due respect to the challenges our male brethren go through, that is something that I don't know that men particularly understand of what an inherent baseline we women experience in this regard.
It's scary. It's scary. And I guess the fact that we are aware of it and we are hip to the fact that this happens, I guess in my opinion is, thank goodness we are being cautious. And even if we are extra cautious, and if people say like, oh, come on, I think being overly cautious is a good thing. And like the risk reward ratio, like Kate just said, I'd be far better served for me to have either a partner to walk with or not do it at all, because going to walk in the woods is not worth an attack. And I guess my only other question that I have to the two of you is, why do you think it took so long? Why do you think it took the 5 years based on when they got the DNA to when they made the match? And it's total opinion here of why you think it took that long.
I had the same question or the same confusion about that. And again, knowing nothing about anything, I'm just going to guess it had some bureaucratic...
My thought was his lawyers might have been not allowing it for a long... Like maybe there were... And this is just a guess. I'm an educated guess that there were motions to prevent that from happening, maybe.
That's
I don't know.
That's a much better guess.
Okay. Oh, I don't know. No, it's probably a lot of BS, but...
Yeah. Or, it took a long time for them to get a warrant for it, or the lawyers kept pushing it. Yeah. I mean, I'm so glad that it happened the way that it did, but...
On this show too, Kate, sorry, Jessica, on this show, we always say that we're experts now. So Jessica, as the attorneys and investigators of this case and the lab.
Kate, you're
forensic,
included in that.
You're included in that.
Yeah.
We're just going to say that the 5 years was for those reasons. We're just, you know, and I'm sure someone's going to find the research and let us know. And that would be great.
I hope they do. As a lawyer at this time, I always look for the best sources of research and the people who are going to help me pursue my law. And
Dr. Weatherhead, we cannot thank you enough for being here today.
Oh,
thank you so much.
Treat you two. I'm so thrilled you're doing this. And I am now a big fan of Killing It on Broadway. It's so good. It's so good. I love it.
It's so good to see your face. And, you know, I hope you're doing okay in this weird, wacky year we call 2020.
I'm doing all right. I'm grateful for things like this and for people like you.
Thanks, girl.
Well, on that note, we absolutely love you, crime fam. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time, keep killing it.
Don't kill anyone.
Killers, go to our Patreon page and join us to get exclusive bonus content and follow us on Instagram at Killing It on Broadway and Twitter at Killing It on B-Way.
Subscribe to us for free wherever you download your podcasts.
And go ahead and give us a 5-star rating and lovely review. It'll be good for you.
Killing It on Broadway is a production of Killing It on Broadway, LLC.
Music by Mary Mitchell Campbell, orchestrations Benedict Braxton Smith.
Edited and engineered by Smokey.
Morale officers, Fred and Nelson. Say goodbye, Fred.
Say goodbye, Nelson.